Lecture 10, The Freedom Fighters.
Welcome back. More than 2,000 years after that autumn day in 480 BC, when a small Greek fleet defeated the great armada of King Xerxes, there in the Straits of Salamis, a young English poet named George Gordon Byron, whom we know as Lord Byron, set out to write a poem that he titled The Isles of Greece that would sum up all the heroic past of the Greeks and serve as a rallying cry, not just to the Greeks, but to his own fellow Englishmen, to try to liberate Greece, which at that time was dominated by the Ottoman Empire. One of the stanzas in The Isles of Greece was inspired by the Battle of Salamis, the battle that we have just lived through. And it goes like this. A king sat on the rocky brow that looks on seaborne Salamis, and ships in thousands lay below, and men in nations, all were his. He counted them at break of day, and when the sun set, where were they? In these few lines, Byron summed up the drama of that day. He meant it to be an example, a beautiful statement of a cause, the idea of liberty for Greece against a foreign invader. But it was more than that, that victory at Salamis. It was one of the hinges of history. It was one of the places where a great movement was checked, where this empire that seemed unstoppable found its limit. On that September day, the world changed. And people at the time were aware of that. Although the immediate results of the Battle of Salamis were some confusion on the Greek side as to whether they had really won, it quickly became apparent that this had set the limit to the Persian expansion into Greece. Marathon had been a victory more cherished by the Athenians because they won it basically all on their own, and Salamis was a collaborative effort. But seen with hindsight, we can understand that when Themistocles, through his guile, his cunning, his exercise of metis, managed to draw the Persians into the straits in the same way that his sort of spiritual ancestor Odysseus had managed to fool the Trojans with the famous Trojan horse, he had set in motion forces that would suddenly alter the balance of the great powers, would catapult Athens to a position of leadership among the Greeks, and open up a new era in the history of the ancient world. However, it's time to get back to the day itself. Xerxes left his high perch and went back to his beautiful pavilion in his main camp on the field outside Athens. There must have been some interesting post-mortems on the Persian side following the battle. We need to remember, though the Greeks must have been sky high to have pushed the Persian fleet out and to have destroyed so many ships, most of the Persian armada had survived. Most were still alive to fight another day. They had failed to root the Greeks out of their little position of hiding there in the straits, their safe corner. But they hadn't lost any ground themselves, and although the Greeks were still entrenched, they, the Persians, were still masters of the sea. So it may not have seemed initially the debacle that it seems today to us looking back on it. Why did they lose? Well, there were a number of factors. They shouldn't have entered the straits. It's clear with hindsight that to fight on the enemy's terms is to break one of the cardinal rules of warfare. You want to make the enemy fight on your terms in territory to your advantage, which would have been for the Persians the open sea. Did they need to go into the channel? They may have thought so, in that bypassing Salamis to take the ships all the way to the isthmus would have left this unbeaten Greek navy at their rear or on their flank. But they outnumbered the Greeks. They could have left a small pair of contingents to bottle up each end of the Salamis Straits and hold the Greeks in there indefinitely. That would have been using one's mind. That would have been using metis in the Greek way. They just didn't consider that possibility. On the day of the battle itself, a terrible error had been made. Themistocles' plan ensured that the Persians, now intending to slip into the straits by night, would have their rowers at the oars the previous day all night long, in other words, almost 24 hours before the battle began, and the battle itself was to last all day. The rowers, the engines that propelled the Persian ships, were exhausted from the beginning. And so no matter how skillful their steersmen may have been, and they were no match for the Greeks, they simply didn't have the power at the oars to do the kinds of maneuvers and charges that might have brought them some victory. Finally, there was the disunity of the Persian fleet, not just among the national contingents, but the disunity of purpose. All those commanders not thinking, what can I do to win this battle, but what can I do to shine more than the people on either side of me in those other ships before the eyes of the great king who was watching me? This is no way to win a battle. All these things contributed to creating a situation in which Greek determination, superior Greek seamanship, and for once, a Greek unity of purpose, the incredible millennial sight of Athenians on one end of the line cooperating with their ancient enemies, the islanders of Aegina, on the other end of the line, the Athenians pushing the Persians out to sea, the Aeginetans taking them from the flank as they went by. For once, the Greeks united together at sea, able to accomplish miracles. There must have been some doubt, though, among the Greeks the next morning, because they had to see with a sinking feeling Phoenician merchantmen, those big freighters that transported grain and wine, being brought into the far end of the straits and tethered to the far shore, the mainland shore, by the Persians, with the realization, oh my gosh, they're going to try to build another bridge of ships to Salamis, or as they saw people bringing loads of rock down to the edge of the shore, they're going to build a mole, a sort of jetty of rock extending out into the channel, which would ultimately reach over and allow Xerxes to get his troops onto the island on dry land. Here is where the psychological force of Xerxes' tradition came into play. The Persians were known for their relentlessness. They never gave up. They never stopped. Setbacks were only temporary with the Persians. And so it must have been with a great sinking feeling that Themistocles, Eurybiades, all the Greeks who had just fought all day long to push the Persians out of the straits at Salamis, saw that the Persians had not folded their tents and gone away, but seemed to be prepared for an entire new phase of the battle. But it was only a ruse. Xerxes had decided to go home. Who helped him to his decision? Artemisia. She was now regarded, of course, as one of the chiefs among his counselors, and she had given the correct advice before the Salamis battle, don't go into the straits. He trusted her a great deal, and she handed him the rationalization that allowed him to leave Greece with honor. Great king, said Artemisia, you should go home. You have accomplished your purpose. Athens is yours. You have burned the great high citadel of the Athenians. You have punished them, as you said you would, for burning the city of Sardis in your father's time. You have accomplished something your father could not do. Something I'm sure she also pointed out to him. It is time for you to leave the end of this campaign to your servants, and above all to your servant Mardonios, who wanted to bring the invasion to Greece in the first place. Leave some of the army with him. He can finish up. And since he and everyone else in your army, they are only your slaves, if they should fail without you, well, it was just a matter of those slaves unable to do your bidding. No discredit will be held to your account. Well, this was exactly what Xerxes wanted to hear, although Herodotus has a humorous passage in which he says he believes that if the entire Persian army had laid down in his path and begged him to stay in Greece, he still would have left. At any rate, he left Mardonius in charge of a core of the Persian army, including some of the picked troops. He himself headed north. The fleet went home. It would have been insane for the Persians to try to pay to supply all those rowers, tens of thousands of rowers, who were doing nothing between October and probably April or May, except eat two or three meals a day. How are you going to do that? Even the great king didn't have that kind of wealth. They left under an odd circumstance. Herodotus says that the Phoenicians of Tyre and Sidon, led by their kings, left without the king's permission, slipping away the day after the battle. It seems odd to us that vassal kings would dare to defy their overlord by doing this. But there may have been an extenuating circumstance. You remember those scribes who stood behind Xerxes, noting down who performed well and who performed badly during the battle. Xerxes was under the impression the Phoenicians had performed badly. What had happened was this. As the Athenians pushed some of the Persian ships up against the shore of Attica, their crews spilled out, they waded to shore, and their captains, their triarchs, came up the hilltop to talk to Xerxes. The Phoenicians came up and said, "O great king, we are losing this battle because of the Ionian Greeks who are fighting in your fleet. They are betraying us. They are fighting in a cowardly way. They are impeding us." And it's maybe true that as the Phoenicians were trying to escape from their position on the right wing, far up the channel, they were being impeded in their escape, as their ships were disabled, by Ionians that got in the way. At any rate, here was the complaint. The Ionians are not fighting well for you. And Xerxes, at that moment, looked down and he saw an amazing feat. One of his Ionian ships rammed another ship. It was Eastern Greeks from the island of Samothrace. They were javelineers. And they rammed another ship, but then they were rammed in their turn by a Greek ship. What did they do? They were immobilized because their ram was stuck in the first ship. They grabbed their javelins. They poured onto the ship that had just rammed them, the Greek ship, cleared its decks with their weapons, took possession of it as their own prize, backed out of their now sinking original ship from Samothrace, and continued to fight for Xerxes. Xerxes said, "You see how my Ionians serve me, off with their heads." And according to Herodotus, who actually knows by name some of the Persians that were around Xerxes and implies that he has firsthand information here, eyewitness accounts, they were beheaded. So it may have been that the kings of Tyre and Sidon, angered by this treatment of their sea captains, had taken the fleets from Phoenicia back home and were willing to suffer the consequences. At any rate, a few days after the Battle of Salamis, the scouts of the Greeks on Salamis, who'd been able to see nothing, they could be looked at all the time from the hills on the mainland, they couldn't see anything except the narrow stretch of water themselves, they finally learned that the Persian fleet was gone. All of this bridge building or mole building, it was a fake to hold them there, and they poured out of the Salamis channel in their ships and set off in pursuit, hoping to catch the Persian fleet before it escaped from Greek waters. They rowed past the vast plain in front of the city of Athens. They saw for the first time the king's pavilion and that whole mass of men and nations, as Byron says, on the plain before them. They raced south to the point at the tip of Attica where the temple of Poseidon stands on its rocky headland. It too, like the temples on the Acropolis, had been burned and destroyed. Beyond it lay the open sea, not a sail, not a ship. The Persian fleet had escaped, but they knew for sure in that moment Salamis had been a great victory after all. They headed home, now somewhat divided among themselves, into what is often called their winter of discontent. The fleet went to the Isthmus to report to the high command there of the Hellenic League led by the Spartans what had happened at Salamis. During this campaign, it happened seemingly first at Artemisium, the Greeks had decided to start voting on who was the most brave in each of their battles. It's sort of like treating them as if they were athletic competitions. The Greeks, of course, loved an agon, a competition, a contest, and they always liked prizes. And unlike that bit in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, "All have won and all must receive prizes." No. There's only one winner. And that person must receive the prize for valor. So they took a vote. Herodotus says that they voted on the altar of Poseidon, casting their ballots, all the commanders of the fleet that had beaten Xerxes' armada at Salamis. Who deserved the prize for valor? Every man's honor, everybody who'd been a commander in the fleet, his honor required that he vote for himself first. But they had voted for a second place, and every one of them named Themistocles as the second place. He'd fought with valor during the battle, but that vote was really a tribute to him They all knew that if 3 years earlier he had not persuaded the Athenians to forego a short-term profit, pool their resources from the amazing silver strike, and build the fleet of 200 triremes, that battle would never have been won. They knew that if Themistocles had not urged them to hold the advance of the Persians at the north end of Euboea, at the Artemisian Straits, everything might have changed if Xerxes had been able to get down unchecked. And they finally knew that if his guile, his cunning, had not lured the Persians into the straits, the battle would never have happened and this great victory would never have occurred. It was probably the high point of Themistocles' life, even though no prize was awarded because nobody had the majority for first place. He had been recognized, and the Spartans treated him like a hero, feasting him, taking him down to Sparta, young Spartans pulling the horses out of his chariot so they could tow the chariot behind them themselves, the kind of treatment only reserved for a divine hero or an Olympic victor. With Themistocles' own Athenians, his standing was less good. Many Athenians who had been in exile, who had been his political rivals, were now back with the mass of Athenians returned from exile during the emergency of the Persian invasion. And the very fact that he was being so feted and lauded by the Spartans went to his head. He became arrogant himself. He built a little temple to the goddess Artemis on the street where he lived to thank her for helping him win this battle for the Greeks. He'd always had kind of an itching palm. He was born to very moderate means. He meant to become rich as well as powerful and famous. And now he got involved in bribes and corruption. So Salamis was his great moment. He will have one more great service to perform for the Greeks that we'll get to next time, or specifically for the Athenians. But it is other commanders who will now take the lead after this winter, where the Greeks begin to feel that all the unity they had the previous year is starting to slip away. For one thing, the line at the Isthmus held. The Peloponnesians showed no sign of coming out of it. And although Athens was now vacated by the Persians, the Athenians were afraid they would come back again from the place where the Persians were encamped. They were spending the winter to the north, that it would all happen again the next year, and that finally, who knows, maybe the Persians would win. Into this time of doubt came a man from the north. He was the king of Macedon. His name was Alexander. Not the Alexander the Great, but an ancestor of his, of the same Greek dynasty that ruled Macedonia in this classical age. He was now a servant, a vassal of Xerxes. He brought a message from General Mardonius of the Persians, saying to the Athenians, "Xerxes knows that you are about to be abandoned by your fellow Greeks. They are leaving Athens to its fate, even though you have done so much for them. If you will submit, just submit, to fight no more against the great king and be his friends, he will restore Athens to you. He will let you govern yourselves in any way that you wish, and he will enrich you beyond your wildest dreams." Well, the Athenians were feeling a little bit betrayed by their fellow Greeks. They had been passed over, not only Themistocles being passed over for the prize for valor, the official prize as an individual, but they, as a contingent of the fleet, had had the mortification of seeing their immense force of 200 triremes passed over in favor of the few ships from the island of Aegina that had been on the right wing next to the Spartans. How just was that? Well, the Athenians felt snubbed. They felt embittered. Some of them probably considered maybe it would be best to accept the great king's offer. Perhaps we're headed for a new world order. Let's find a good place for Athens in it. But the majority said no. They told Alexander, king of Macedon, "Go back and tell the Persians no amount of gold will make the Athenians betray the Greek cause." So the next spring opened with the Greeks aware they had two campaigns yet ahead of them. Tackle this Persian army that had remained in Greece and deal with the menace of the Persian fleet still outnumbering us, possibly ruling the Aegean. The Spartans had now awakened fully to the importance of the naval side. They had appointed an admiral who was a Spartan the previous year, the famous year of 480 BC when Xerxes was in Greece. That was Eurybiades. Now they gave the assignment to a king, one of the two kings. They upgraded the naval arm. This king was Leotychidas. Leonidas, of course, was dead. The other king was so young that there was a regent in charge of that other branch of the dual Spartan kingship. His name was Pausanias. And the Spartans had found in him a man a lot like Themistocles. Very ambitious, very clever, very charismatic, and a man able to persuade people to forget their differences and unite in a common cause. Pausanias, the regent of Sparta, would lead the forces on land. Leotychidas went to Aegina. Athens had even been stripped of the honor of being the headquarters of the fleet, and on the island of Aegina, amassed a small force, only 50 or 60 triremes, that would be watching the waters of the Greek world to make sure that the Persian fleet did not reinvade. Let's follow the fortunes of the land army first. It became plain that Mardonius and his Persians were uncertain about where to fight. They wanted a vast plain where they could deploy their cavalry. They still knew that the cavalry with its lancers and bowmen was their strongest arm. There was one plain near Athens, the plain of Eleusis, site of the shrine of the Eleusinian Mysteries. They, in fact, came back to Athens, and this time, in their fury at the Athenians not surrendering, they destroyed the whole city. So Athens became a vast disaster area. The only buildings left standing were Athenian houses where the Persian officers had billeted themselves. Everything else was gone. Everything was destroyed. The walls, if there were any, had been thrown down. The city was a smoking ruin as the Persians left and sought a place to meet the Greeks. They finally crossed over the hills, over Mount Kithaeron, going north into the vast plains of Boeotia. The city of Thebes had Medized. It had surrendered to Xerxes. They built a vast palisaded camp. The palisade was supposed to be a great square, a mile on each side of wooden uprights, a stockade that was made of the fruit trees of the Thebans. They had submitted to Xerxes, but that meant that everything they had was his, and so all of their orchards were cut down to make the uprights for this vast fence. Inside there was the army. Outside was an immense plain where Mardonius felt confident of beating the Greeks. Pausanias summoned all of the allies, all of the resistance. Amazingly, even after the successes of 480 at sea, and after the heroic death of Leonidas in the pass at Thermopylae, there were still people hanging back. Nonetheless, Pausanias brought north, over the passes of the mountains, an army that ultimately numbered 38,700 Greek hoplites. This time, most of the Athenian hoplites were there with the main force. Pausanias wanted no more of this fighting at sea for Athens. They needed to be doing their contribution along with the other Greeks on land. So the Athenians joined the other Greeks. They were under the command of that man we've met before, Aristides, called the Just, probably because he was a good arbiter. It was very common in the Greek world if you had a difference to settle it out of court, certainly between nations or two islands, they would find a disinterested party and have that person come and be an arbiter. That's how he would get this nickname, Aristides the Just. He was universally respected, incorruptible, very honest, and he was at the lead of the Athenian hoplites at Plataea. They came down over the mountain, over Mount Kithaeron. They came down onto its lower slopes. As they came over the pass, they could see Thebes. They could see the great square of the palisaded camp of the Persians. They all knew this territory very well, and they realized as soon as they were off the mountain, beyond the little foothills at its base, they would be mowed down. So began a very strange battle. It led to a battle at a place called Plataea. Plataea was the town in Boeotia that had sent its men to Marathon to help the Athenians. But near Plataea, there were little hills and there were springs of water, so that these tens of thousands of Greeks had a good water supply all night long. And carts were bringing food over the mountains from free Greece to the south to supply this huge army. Pausanias knew, if I attack, they will destroy me. I must wait here until they attack us. Mardonius out on the plain, the Persian knew equally. If I go up on their territory, I am fighting in terrain where my horses will have trouble maneuvering. Nonetheless, he decided to take the first action. After all, his head was at stake. If he failed to conquer Greece for Xerxes, who knew what would happen? He had to bring on a battle. A year that ended without a decisive victory for the Persians, or at least an attempt at a battle, was unthinkable as far as Mardonius was concerned. So he began by sending up some of his famous Persian horsemen. They came up along the Athenian ranks, and they threw their javelins at the Athenians. And by a lucky shot, and by a lucky chance, the Athenians had brought some archers. Archers were not well thought of among the Greeks. You'll all remember in the story of the Trojan War, the archer Paris, who shoots a Achilles in the heel. That's considered a cowardly way to fight. Well, nonetheless, the Athenians had some archers. One of their archers managed to get an arrow into the horse of the commander of the Persian force, a man named Megistius. And as the horse fell, so did the commander. And he was very conspicuous. He was wearing a sort of a plate of gold mail that looked like fish scales, gilded fish scales, and he had a scarlet cloak. And the Persians had been running up, launching their missiles, and then turning to retreat, and then coming back again. It was on one of those turns that Megistius' horse was hit. The other Persians didn't see it. They had already turned and were in their tactical retreat. The Athenians surged forward, surrounded him, killed him. And then, as the Persians, realizing what had happened, came to try to retrieve the body of their fallen leader, the Athenians managed to get him back to their lines and treated his corpse as a first great trophy of what they hoped would be the victory to come. So this made Mardonius more determined than ever to attack. And finally, Pausanias realized, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to do some of the same kind of luring that Themistocles did, only not with words, but with actions. So Pausanias ordered, first of all, his army to divide. The Athenians and the left wing went off on their own. He and the main force seemed to retreat behind the little range of hills where they'd been into an area where they couldn't be easily seen. Mardonius, assuming that this was a sign of them pulling back altogether, thought there's no better way to catch an army of hoplites than in the rear because they've got no armor on their backs. So you can always catch them once they're on the retreat. So he launched the attack of his cavalry. And they divided in order, some of them to take the Athenians, some of them to go after the main body. But as they came up and over the hill, they made the horrifying discovery that it had all been a ruse. Not a ruse, a very tactical retreat. They found the Spartans and their allies in good order, and although they hurled themselves against that phalanx wall, the cavalry, the horses, were daunted by the bristling spears of the phalanx. They were unable to break the formation with the Athenians also. There was no way to get them off their little slope and to defeat them. And gradually, the Greek hoplites forging their way down onto the terrain more favorable to the horses, the cavalry of the Persians, won the day. Mardonius was hurt by the fact that his second-in-command, a royal Persian named Artabazos, was not heart and soul in this, resented Mardonius and his command, and actually left the battlefield at a time when he could have still been effectively fighting for the Persian side. He headed north. What he told the great king later was apparently that I saved as much as I could from the disaster at Plataea for your future campaigns, and he was well rewarded by Xerxes. But the fact was, Mardonius was killed, the great stockade was stormed, the Athenians were the ones who had the sort of siege craft to get over the wall and lead all the Greek troops inside. They found the bronze manger where Mardonius' white stallion had taken its grain. They got all kinds of treasure and loot from Plataea, and they all met there in the stockade after the battle was over. Now, beforehand, they had said, we're going to swear an oath before we go down to Plataea. And the oath was that they would fight to the death and never surrender. And that at the end, they would swear to dedicate to the gods who had helped them win the battle 1/10 of all of the loot that they found. And so 1/10 of it was set aside to make statues and victory monuments dedicated to the gods. The rest was shared out among the states, paying them back for some of the tremendous costs that they'd suffered in this war. And they had the satisfaction of knowing that the remnant of the Persian army was now headed north as fast as it could go, trying to get out of Greece and back to safety. The war on land had been won. When the news spread across the Aegean, it reached the Greek fleet. Leotychidas, the Spartan admiral, had been lured himself across to the Asiatic side by the Greeks of Asia, who'd heard about the successes at Salamis, who now felt that the time for their liberation was at hand, and who believed that this little Greek fleet could be the force that would finally destroy the remnants of Xerxes' naval force, as we know the remnants of his armed force were being destroyed at Plataea, and that if they could only get Leotychidas, the Spartans, and the few Athenians who were with that fleet over to Ionia, the war at sea could be finally conclusively won there also. The place they came to after stopping first on the island of Delos halfway across was the island of Samos. They learned, these Greeks in their ships, that the Persians had gone to Mount Mycale. The coasts of that large, dark mountain came almost up and touched the island of Samos. They were told by scouts that the whole Persian fleet, all that was left of it, was drawn up there on the coasts of Mount Mycale. And there we must leave them at Samos, laying their plans to forge ahead and see if they can finally destroy the last remaining element of Xerxes' great invasion force there at Mycale. They later said that their battle at Mycale happened on the very day of the Battle of Plataea, and that in fact the Spartan king Leotychidas had been inspired to say to his men that a great battle had been won in Greece, and they could add to the glory and the victory by winning a great battle here in Asia. Circumstances proved him to be speaking the truth when it was later learned that the two great conflicts were fought on the same day. We've been today on land. We will go back to sea next time and explore the Greek victory over the Persians in the naval battle, the strangest one ever fought, at Mycale.